I'm Holly Case of Cornell University, and this is East Central Europe Past and Present, a blog series that brings you interviews with scholars of East Central and Southeastern Europe, Russia, and the former Soviet Union, in which they offer their views on the past, present, and future of the region. I'm in Istanbul today, where I had the good fortune of running into someone I've long wanted to interview, and that's Ron Suni, who is the Charles Tilly Collegiate Professor of Social and Political History at the University of Michigan, and also Emeritus Professor of Political Science and History at the University of Chicago. Ron was the president of the American Association for the Advancement of Slavic Studies, when it was known as the AAASS, now known as SEES or ASEEES. He has written and edited several books on Russian, Soviet, Armenian, and Georgian history, including The Revenge of the Past, Nationalism, Revolution, and the Collapse of the USSR, published in 1993, and The Soviet Experiment, Russia, the USSR, and the Successor States, published by Oxford in 1998, as well as many edited volumes on nationalism, the Caucasus, the Russian Revolution, and the Armenian Genocide. He now has books on Stalin, the historiography of the Soviet Union, and Russia's empires, also in the publication Q. In short, he's a madman. Thank you for agreeing to speak with me, Ron.
My pleasure.
So, you've written on a lot of different periods and places, but it seems to me as though Soviet history is kind of your mother country. Could you explain, is that a fair assessment?
Yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. When I grew up, I remember around the dinner table, my father, mm-hmm. who was born and raised during the revolution in Tbilisi, he was an Armenian, but from Georgia, he would tell these stories about how the Bolsheviks came to Tiflis in 1921, and that roused my interest in these things. And he, being a person of the left, and very sympathetic to the Soviet project, I was always fascinated by what was going on there. So that's mm-hmm. how I started.
Oh,
this.
Fantastic. Could you talk a bit more about how your father, and did both of your parents experience the revolution there, or how your father experienced it?
My mother was born in the States. She was the daughter of immigrants from Turkey. So I have, in my life, I've had Armenians from Turkey and Armenians from Russia. Mm-hmm. And they both left, her parents left before the genocide. So they survived, and her father lived to be a ripe old age of 100, wow. though his mother, father, and family were murdered during the genocide in 1915. So that was one side. They were more kind of church people and fairly conservative, very much Armenian patriots. My father's side was a leftist group. My grandfather was a member of the Armenian sort of committee of the Philadelphia Communist Party, right? And very pro-Soviet until in 1937, he criticized Stalin from a safe distance in Philadelphia mm-hmm. and was basically censured and thrown out of the party. But he still died as a believer. He was a composer, Grigor Suni, and his music was then never played again in Armenia until the 1960s, long after Stalin died.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what kinds of things did your father say about his experience of the revolution?
Well, he encouraged me to think differently about the Soviet Union in the mm-hmm. during the years of the Cold War. I remember I was about 10 or 11 years old, and I had to give a report in school, and my father said, why don't you know, this is 1951, imagine, McCarthy period. Mm-hmm. And he said, you go and tell them that the Soviet Union is not as bad as they say it is. They beat fascists during the Second World War. They're reconstructing the country, all of these kinds of things. So I went in, and this little boy, skinny little 10-year-old, gives this report. The teacher turned white. She asked, who told you these things? I said, well, my father told me, and I did research in the World Book Encyclopedia and found out all of these things. She was shocked. And from that day on, in school, I was known as Comrade Suni. So then it became my job in life to learn about the Soviet Union and figure out what was really going on. And I would say that, you know, even though I was always hopeful that this poor country, this beleaguered country, would build a decent society, and we've had trouble doing that, I am very sympathetic to the efforts of finding alternatives to Western capitalism, hopefully more democratic, more social, really social democratic. But that became my sort of motivation to learn about this history, and that's what is reflected somewhat in this book, The Soviet Experiment, which is a history of the Soviet Union. When I ask my students, what do you think the dominant emotion is in that book? And they listen, well, maybe nostalgia. I said, well, no, it's regret. Regret that things didn't turn out differently. Or, you know, there was a joke in 1970, Lenin came back on his 100th anniversary of his birth, looked around and said, ну, мы хотели строить советскую власть. Ну, не получилось. Said, you know, we wanted to build Soviet power, but it didn't turn out right. And that's the story that I tell in a way, is how this was a great effort to create a new kind of society, and ultimately, не получилось. Yeah. Ultimately, didn't quite work out that way.
Well, and I've seen in some of your writings, you know, places where you tried to work out, you know, what exactly didn't work, or where it kind of went wrong. And if I'm not mistaken, I mean, most of the emphasis there is on the immediate post-revolutionary period or during the revolution itself, that somehow that is where you have to look. And have you worked out in your own mind and to your own satisfaction, like, what went wrong?
Never completely, Holly, I would say. You know, these are always open questions. That's what's exciting about Russian history. They always come back to you. But I would say, from a Marxist point of view, or even any other sensible point of view, Russia was the worst place in the world to try to build anything called socialism. They haven't done so well with capitalism, and they messed up with feudalism a little bit too. But, you know, so it doesn't, they haven't done that well. You know, and they keep trying. I'm a believer in the fact that, you know, the revolution was not made by Lenin and the Bolsheviks. It was made in February. Crowds of people went out into the streets of Petrograd, and they tried to create a new world, and it was extraordinarily radically democratic in 1917. People out there arguing and all the rest of it, but ultimately the war, the civil war, the Bolsheviks' own inclinations, the failure for the rest of Europe to ignite in support of the Russian Revolution, but instead to try to destroy it, all of that led not to a democratic or, I would say, really socialist outcome, but more to a kind of authoritarian regime that then imposed its own vision of what Stalin would ultimately say was socialism on the people. So the roots of this failure, if you want to call it, lie in the nature of Russia, in the intentions and misdirections of the Bolsheviks themselves. You know, lots of different causes. We historians think of things as very overdetermined usually. This was one of those things that's very overdetermined.
Well, and when I hear you speaking, I think I have a sense of the Soviet Union as some people probably at the time wanted to imagine it, something, or as did imagine it, and people for whom it was most real were those who didn't conflate it necessarily with Russia. And to what extent, I mean, you talked a bit about how Russia didn't get these other things right either. To what extent can the Russian experience be disaggregated from the Soviet in historical terms?
That's a good question. And I might have answered it differently before 1991, when certain things that were annoying when we went to the Soviet Union, we always thought as a Soviet, you know, this doesn't work, too bureaucratic, too many rules, people aren't working hard enough, all those kinds of things. Now, since 1991, and looking back to before 1917, a lot of this is the nature of the country itself. I don't mean it in any essentialist way, that it's sort of doomed to be different from the rest of the world. But it was a highly peasant country. 80-some percent of the people were peasants. It was late in industrialization. It never had a bourgeoisie. And you could say it never had a bourgeois revolution. The greatest revolution in modern history, as Marx tells us, was capitalism, the biggest change in human life since the Neolithic Revolution, that, you know, put people on the land growing crops. And this changed the nature of the world, but not Russia in the same way, right? Not Russia in the same way. So they didn't have all those kind of Weberian, what you might call bourgeois values and understandings, you know, of hard work, efficiency, time is money, etc., etc. That kind of thing didn't develop as well in Russia. Now, they tried, after the fall of the Soviet Union, to inculcate a kind of capitalist mentality and capitalist enterprise. But we've ended up with what I would call a kind of pirate capitalism, or, you know, oligarchic capitalism, in which various people who stole from the Soviet people and stole from the Soviet social product their own private wealth, and now they sort of run the country in their own interest.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to go back a bit, and if you could go to the point. So when was the first time that you visited the Soviet Union?
I first visited the Soviet Union in 1964. I was there the day that Khrushchev fell from power in October 1964, which a good friend of mine called the Second October Revolution, because it was the first time a Soviet leader actually fell and wasn't killed right away, but managed to survive and write his memoirs, etc. And I was in love with the Soviet Union, I would say. I loved the fact that it was so different from the West, that money was seemingly unimportant, that people read vociferously while on the metro, that there was a sense of общество, or society, of община, общественность, you know, communal feeling. I remember sitting on the subway and crossing my legs akimbo, and a woman, a peasant woman coming up, or maybe not a peasant woman, but an older woman, slapping my legs, thinking she had the right to do that. Молодой человек, young man, это не деревня, не культурно так сидеть. It's not culture to sit like that. This is not a village. And the fact that someone would feel they had the right to intervene in your private space, so different from, you know, I was thrilled by all of the way that the difference in almost the human nature that had been developed in the Soviet Union, for good and bad. I mean, I don't want to romanticize it, but it was different. And it was something that very exciting to me because, for me, history, like anthropology, are the sciences that allow us to conceive of something beyond the now, beside what was just existing. And that gives us a kind of, I think, subversive and revolutionary potential to think outside of, you know, the dystopia that we live in. You can tell I'm not particularly thrilled with capitalism and bourgeois democracy.
And what were the circumstances under which you went then in 1964?
My uncle took me and his nephew to go to Armenia. So we sailed from Istanbul to Sochi and then took a train to Armenia because he was building a factory there, a dry cleaning plant, in 1964. And I was, a year later when I applied for the exchange program, people from the government came to interview me about this strange visit and these communists who I had gone to Armenia with. I almost didn't get to go on the exchange program for that reason. But Henry Roberts, a very distinguished historian at Columbia at the time, who wrote this great book on Romania, which you probably know, in fact, went to bat for me, and I got on the exchange program in 65, 66, and then spent 10 months in Moscow, and was the first exchange student to go to the Caucasus on that American-Soviet exchange, and spent months in Yerevan and Tbilisi.
Wow. And what was that like?
Fantastic. Yeah. I loved it, you know. I thought I was in a wonderful world. I never complained about the difficulties of Soviet life, because I thought, you know, socialism is hard. It's hard to build this kind of place, you know. Mm-hmm. And I tried to mingle and stay in with Russians or Armenians as much as possible and not go to the embassy so much as many of my colleagues were doing, or constantly be whining about all the difficulties. Oh, no toilet paper. Oh, the food is not good. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, this is so difficult. I sort of just dove in and really liked it, and learned Russian as well as I could and Armenian as well as I could.
How do you think you're, I mean, because a lot of people, I think of your generation and the one just after, came to an obsession with the region, maybe through Dostoevsky and with the Cold War in the background, kind of a romance. And so it was through Russian culture that was their access point. But your access point was not really through Russian culture. How do you think this has shaped your perspective on Soviet history?
Oh, I think very much. My interest was in, and many of us, you know, if you think of Reggie Zelnick and Bill Rosenberg and Ziva Galili and a whole generation of people, we were interested in the labor movement, in workers, in social history. We were moving towards social history, which in my case would have been more like socialist history, though we were living in America, not Britain, so we couldn't say that. And not Eric Hobsbawm or E.P. Thompson. But we were learning from those guys. We were interested in Marxism. As not in a very dogmatic way or in a Soviet way, but as a kind of opening to question some of the paradigms of liberalism that were so dominant in the profession, and to look at things much more totally. I mean, if there was one or two things that Marxism gave us, it was a radical historicity, a radical historicism, that is to see everything as in flux and historically created by human beings rather than as essentially there or natural, right? This would become later what was so powerful in constructivism and feminism, that is, everything can be questioned, nation, class, gender. But we were already there a bit with Marxism because the thing that seems so natural, capitalism, you know, and the human nature formed by capitalism, to us was historically a construction, right, to be questioned. And the Soviet Union, the experience of living there and seeing that people did live differently and thought differently under very harsh and difficult conditions, right, was very inspiring to someone like me and to many of my generation, I think. We were not anti-Soviet. We were, anti-Sovietism, anti-communism was an ideology and an approach that distorted, in our view, understanding the Soviet Union. We were detentists in a way. We wanted a different, more benign relationship with the Soviet Union.
So when you, I'm sure you've had many conversations with leftists in the United States and elsewhere who just don't know anything about the Soviet Union.
Right.
What are they missing, or what did they miss that somebody who knows something about the Soviet Union and who has made it an object of study kind of, I mean, do you ever look at them and just think they're naive on some fronts, or what are the points at which you can communicate with such people and points after which, you know, you just think, go read a couple of books and then we'll talk?
Well, my father, I was raised during the Cold War, and my father said, because they had been, his generation had been hurt by this, never join any organization. So I never joined any party. I never joined any organization. I probably always voted Democrat because it was the only alternative to insanity in our country. So I in some ways would admire people who would stick their neck out and be involved in left-wing politics. But there are two kinds of left-wing politics in America. One is a kind of very sectarian, almost dogmatic Marxism that you find, unfortunately, among many Trotskyists, and I very much admire Trotsky, and some of those people. If you ask one Trotskyist, do you know so-and-so who's another Trotskyist, they're of different parties, you know, so they never get along. And yet, you know, that critique of Marxism and Trotskyism, anti-Stalinism, had a kind of attractiveness to it. On the other side, most American leftists are not Marxist and not particularly ideological. It's sort of like the Occupy movement or SDS. It was definitely against leadership and organization and any ideology. And I also found that somewhat sympathetic, but never anything that I thought would change radically the system or anything like that. What it did change was the culture. And that was significant. So living in the United States in the 1950s was a kind of totalitarian existence. There were very strict rules about how you should look and how you should act and all of the rest of it in a kind of Foucauldian sense, you know, not from government, but in the way knowledge was produced and habits were produced in society. And after the 60s, that was different. Your hair could be long. Mm-hmm. You could dress the way you wanted. You could be gay eventually if you wanted. Relationships with women were different. Relationships with people of color were different. Mm-hmm. So that was the revolution that the left helped achieve in America.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm understanding you right, what the people who know about the Soviet Union had, and this might not be categorically the case, was a skepticism vis-a-vis institutionalization of leftism.
I think that's right. Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. You know, I was sympathetic to the Soviet project. I wanted them to do well. Mm-hmm. But I was also extraordinarily critical in my very first article that I wrote for something called Alternatives at Oberlin College, where I first taught, about its anti-democratic quality. That is, socialism is radical democracy. Mm-hmm. Right? I believe you can't have real democracy without some kind of socialism. Mm-hmm. But you can't have socialism without democracy, because people have to make decisions and guide their own life. And that, of course, was not true in the Soviet Union, where the party dictated things to people for their own good, supposedly, but, you know, not giving them the choice. So, you know, it was hard to defend the Soviet Union any kind of uncritical way, the way, say, the Communist Party might or something like that.
Did that mean that there was overlap between the thinking of, you know, leftists like yourself and people who were dissidents, basically, who were not so much on the left, and who were kind of pushing back against institutions? I mean, I don't know, the people like Joseph Brodsky, for example. Was there a point at which, you know, you couldn't tell yourself and Joseph Brodsky apart?
Oh, no, I wouldn't say that at all, because people like Brodsky and Solzhenitsyn and so were very conservative.
Yeah. And was that always clear?
Yeah, and their anti-communism put them in another place. Now, there were people we were more sympathetic with. Mm-hmm. The first dissidents, I hope I get this right, the first dissidents were actually kind of socialist dissidents, mm-hmm. if you go back far enough. And those were sympathetic, you know. The kinds of people sometimes that Solzhenitsyn writes about in the Shalashka, you know, I'm forgetting the name, but it's Kopolev, I think his name is. Is there?
Oh, Zev?
No. Maybe I'm getting the name wrong here. But really interesting people who were on the left. And then, of course, Sakharov was always a very sympathetic figure because he was so noble, so naive, so democratic, people who wanted to sort of change the Soviet Union from within to make it live up to its own constitution. Mm-hmm. To live up to its own aspirations. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's most interesting when you read some of these earlier accounts, say like Sarah Davies' book, that reads, what, from the archive, tells us what was in the police reports, right? Mm-hmm. When you read them, you realize that people are saying things like, they're not anti-socialist, all of them. They're saying things like, but how come we don't have what you promised us? Mm-hmm. How come we don't have equality? How come, in fact, you're not producing something more just here? So there's this sense in which there were these aspirations towards social justice, sort of equality, that lived in Russia in the Soviet times. And by the way, that still live there, mm-hmm. right? So a lot of the nostalgia for the Soviet Union is because of what they've experienced under capitalism and so-called democracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, part of the reason why I mentioned Brodsky is because I think there's a preoccupation in your work with a couple of things, and one of them is nationalism, and I'd like to return to that in a bit later. But another is violence, I think your interest in violence in the Soviet context is more oblique, whereas it's much more overt in the case of the Armenian genocide. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a kind of fascination with it, one way or another, especially in the revolutionary legacy. Mm. And that my sense is that you're trying to work out something about, you know, the relationship between violence and the construction of an alternative. And I was reading a piece that you wrote for The Nation, where you were talking about At the end, you had, it was about the revolution, basically, and at the end you mentioned the metaphor of, you know, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, and then you extended that metaphor in a very, I think, humorous way, you know, like you should make sure that you don't smash the eggs such that the shells and everything get cooked in with the omelet, and that a lot of people, when they think of the revolution, you know, that's the metaphor that they use, you know, like, well, if you want the product... And one of Brodsky's most famous poems that I only understood when I read your piece was, he has a line in it that's like, broken eggs make me grieve, the omelet, though, makes me vomit. And, you know, it was only after reading your piece that I kind of realized how loaded that that line is. And it made me wonder, I mean, the main question it raised is about the relationship in your mind between violence and promised utopia. And I've heard you discuss things like this with my own advisor, Norman Neymark, around the issue of whether or not what Stalin did could be presumed to be a genocide, and how violence figures in, on the one hand, the construction of a polity versus... you know, the destruction of a people, basically, and whether those two things can ever be considered in tandem. How does it stand in your thinking now? You know, are these essentially two different kinds of violence? And if so, what are the typologies that you would give to them?
Politics, said Foucault, is war by other means, right? So it's not just that war is politics by other means, as Clausewitz said, but politics is war by other means. Mm-hmm. And I suppose this comes out of Marxism, but other points of view as well. There's no state without violence, ultimately. That's how you control criminality. That's how you deal with revolution or rebellion. That's how you fight wars to preserve the state, etc. So hopefully at a certain point states are stable enough, democratic enough, that you don't need the open display of violence at all times. It's very different when you're forming a state. It's very different when you overthrow czarism or the provisional government and foreign armies and whites and greens and everyone opposes you. And Lenin was, of course, a very practical politician. Lenin thought revolution is war. And you play it by the rules of war, and that's how you win. That is, you have men with guns at the right place at the right time. He says this. And he reads Clausewitz when he goes off in the summer into hiding in Finland. He takes Clausewitz and Hegel. I'm not sure why the Hegel, but I guess he needed the dialectic as well. But he does have Clausewitz. So I think that's right. That is what politics is about, particularly revolutionary politics. Now, normal politics, hopefully, is about compromise, negotiation, giving and taking. If you lose, you hope to come back later in a democratic way. Not simply opposing, your opponent. Though apparently Republicans in the Senate and House of Representatives are more Leninist than they are these kinds of democratic politicians. They really do see an enemy out there that they're not going to give in to. But so violence is built into those things. Most nation states, and the nation state is as much a utopia as communism was, or will be. That is, forming a homogeneous group of people by ethnicity or whatever leads or demands certain kinds of violence, ethnic cleansing or genocide, ultimately, or forced assimilation of some kind. And we're watching this all over the world today, right? Mm-hmm. And so the Armenian... So, you know, Lenin wanted to build a state, socialism, take power, hold power, export the revolution. Violence was part of that thing. That violence, of course, corrupts and distorts the utopian end. Mm-hmm. But the absence of that violence means you'll never get anywhere anyway. Mm-hmm. You could take Gorbachev as the opposite of Lenin. Gorbachev refused to use violence. Really, most of the violence was done by others, not by Gorbachev. He never overthrew a single president of Lithuania or Estonia or anywhere while he was in power. He didn't use violence because he didn't believe that you could, through violence, build real democracy. Mm-hmm. And so he lost power to people ready to use violence, including Yeltsin, who you remember bombarded his own White House. People died in that coup d'etat of October 19, 93. And Gorbachev then became this kind of, you know, lonely figure. Mm-hmm. So not understanding that state building and state making and state holding demands some degree of the use of power and force and violence means you will not play a political role, really. Mm-hmm. In genocide, and the Armenian genocide, in genocide for me, I should say, and this is somewhat where my disagreement with Norman is, and we are good enough friends that we disagree on these two things. Genocide for me is not the killing of people, not the mass killing of people. It is the killing of a people. It is the violence directed by a state against a designated ethnic, cultural, religious, linguistic group, an ethnicity, a people, a nation, a nationality. Norman extends that to say that classes are invented nations in a way or something like that, and so that all kinds of killing, like Stalin's purges, the deportation of the Chechens, the Holodomor, all become then genocides. And the term, to my mind, as an Armenian, loses its precision of a particular kind of violence that can be explained. So for social scientists, it seems to me better to contain the definition, right? Mm-hmm. Closer to what the UN definition is, though not exactly that definition, which is a little bit elastic itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in some sense, then, I think what you're saying is that a polity that's being born kind of must use violence. But, if considering something like the Armenian genocide, that a state, when it's dying, it should die quietly. And, you know, but the interesting contrast then is, you know, Gorbachev did precisely that. Yeah. He let the Soviet Union die quietly.
He didn't want to do that. No, it just happened that way.
Right, but he let it happen, yeah. Right? It was probably within his means to prevent it from happening, and he let it happen, which is a great contrast with what happened in the Ottoman Empire. Alternatively, however, maybe there are people who talk about, like somebody like Taner Akçam, he'll talk about the moment at which the Armenian genocide is taking place as not so much as the end of something as of the beginning of something. Mm-hmm. You know, that the Republican, those who became the Republicans cut their teeth on this mm-hmm. phenomenon, that this is actually a beginning, it's not an end. Mm-hmm. In your mind, where does the Armenian genocide sit in Ottoman and Turkish history? Mm-hmm. You know, like, is it the end of something? Is it the beginning of something? Or how would you describe it?
Okay, let me just go back a second to Gorbachev.
Yes.
Gorbachev allowed the Soviet Union to fall apart without using violence. But let's not forget, the Soviet Union is still unraveling today. Mm-hmm. So Ukrainian struggles and killings there is part of that. Mm-hmm. The Tajik civil war, in which some 50,000 were killed, was part of that unraveling. Nagorno-Karabakh, the Russo-Georgian war of 2008, Abkhazia, Chechnya, tens and tens and tens of thousands of people died because we lost the Soviet Union, right? Mm-hmm. And here I'm close to the Putin thing, that was a disaster, that the Soviet Union fell apart, that it should have evolved into a more democratic, hopefully social democratic state. It didn't need a liberal Bolshevik revolution of the kind that Yeltsin made. That's my view.
Could we just continue on this?
Yes.
Because, you know, the cautionary tale, though, is not so much. I mean, we're living in a time when lots of polities have died, specifically empires. If you want to look at the Soviet Union as an empire.
Well, it was an empire.
Let's say, so that one's dead. France as an empire, Britain as an empire, the United States, people talk about it as an empire. And so, you know, like, part of the reason why this is interesting is because it sort of raises the question, what is the proper way for a really big polity to exit, you know, the scene? Because that seems to be the tenor of our, you know, extended moment, let's say, the protracted.
But you're missing an alternative. The end of empire does not necessarily mean the creation of nation states or homogeneous ethno-nation states as occurred in the fall of the Soviet Union or Yugoslavia. It could mean the transition of an empire into a multinational state, mm-hmm. something looser, maybe a confederation, something even looser than that, like the European Union or something like that. Mm-hmm. Gorbachev was actually moving in that direction. Right. That is what the Union Treaty was about.
The common
and it
European
was undermined by Yeltsin and Khrushchev. Kuchma, whatever his name was now, who can remember all these names, and other people like that. So it wasn't that you needed... The empire was over before Gorbachev fell. The Soviet system had been dissolved. They were having multi-party elections. They had parliaments. They had, you know, all kinds of different things going on. Mm-hmm. It's the Union that fell ultimately because of Yeltsin and the Belarusian and Ukrainian bosses conspiring in Belarus to end it. Mm-hmm. And that was unpopular with most people in the Soviet Union at that time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there were alternatives, but some ambitious politicians drinking heavily at the moment, in fact, brought down the great state, which didn't have to happen. Though there are lots of other reasons why that state fell apart, too. Mm-hmm. On the Armenian genocide, I would say, you know, the Young Turks, who came to power in 1908, who evolved into a kind of Turkic nationalists, who wanted to reform their empire in a more Turkic and more Muslim formation, mm-hmm. never giving up, by the way, the idea of empire. They weren't going to give up the Arab lands and so forth. Mm-hmm. They were even going to try to get back the Balkans if they could have. They had ambitions in the Caucasus as well. Nevertheless, these Turkic nationalists, I see the Young Turks as empire preservers rather than ethno-nation state makers a la Kemal. And their choices were not only demographic rearrangement, not only forced Islamization, but physical murder of designated peoples, namely Armenians and Assyrians. And that policy is in no way justifiable. What it actually did was weaken, from a realpolitik point of view, weaken the Turkish state, the Ottoman state, and ultimately helped bring it to defeat. They destroyed productive farmers. They lost a middle class. They undermined what civil society the Ottoman Empire had been building. It would take them another half century to rebuild it. Mm-hmm. And they lost loyal population. They were actually tens of thousands of Armenians in the Ottoman Empire army fighting the Russians, Armenians on the other side fighting the Ottomans, who were then demobilized, disarmed, their uniforms taken away, turned into what's called amele tabulare, that is, work battalions, mm-hmm. and ultimately murdered as the first stage of the genocide.
Let's return to the issue of nationalism, because I think it's very apropos. So, I mean, I'm going to make a rough characterization, then you can correct for it. So if Soviet history has a hang-up, it's the legacy of the revolution. If Eastern European history has a hang-up, it's nationalism. Mm. And I think you've contemplated both pretty heftily. I'm not sure that would, you know, make you an honorary Eastern Europeanist.
We used to bring them together at Columbia when there was an East Central European Institute, there was a Russian Institute, and we all worked together. And yeah. I studied with Joseph Rothschild and knew East Van Deyck very well. So, yeah.
Oh, that's something that I wanted.
I was all involved in that
stuff. Oh, good. Yeah, I'm going to ask an area studies question later. but, you know, it seems to me as though, like, your field has been more infected by our preoccupations than ours has by yours. Mm. And do you think that's just a product of our moment, or is it just wrong? You know, like, am I mischaracterizing, or how would you explain how that happened?
In my lifetime, in my career as a Soviet historian, mm-hmm. people were not particularly interested in nationalism and the non-Russian nationalities. Okay, mm-hmm. we go back to the 60s and 70s. Those who were interested were primarily captive nation types, mm-hmm. or emigres from the region, right, who still held out for some kind of nationalist interpretations. Mm-hmm. But the mainstream Soviet historians were interested in Moscow, in Petersburg, in the top, maybe as we moved into social history, the labor movement, then eventually women's movement, cultural history, things like that. A few of us, for whatever reason, maybe because I was born an Armenian in America, decided we're going to study something outside of the center. So I wrote my first book on the Baku Commune, mm-hmm. a revolution, and it was about class and nationality conflicts and how class conflicts morphed into national conflicts from 1917 into 1918. That was the essence of that book. And I was interested in studying the non-Russian peoples. And the dominant paradigm at that time was that nationalism was unimportant in the Soviet Union, that nationality had been largely erased or was impotent, and that what had actually happened in the prison house of nations that the Soviet Union had become was that the Soviet regime had destroyed or was in the process of destroying nations, sort of Robert Conquest point of view, and that Russification was the dominant paradigm. And when I went to Armenia and Georgia and observed what was actually going on and talked to my Armenian and Georgian friends, I realized something else is going on here. There's actually nations being born here. And there are a few people like Teresa Rakowska-Harmstone and others who were seeing this, but very few. Mm-hmm. Not historians particularly, political scientists maybe, Barbara Anderson, Brian Silver, a few others were seeing that something else is going on. Nationalities are not dying out here. And so I began to work on a counter-paradigm, which was that actually, the way I put it, I think, was in The Revenge of the Past, that the Soviet Union was the crucible of nations. It was actually nations were born there. Mm-hmm. And through reading Mary Matossian and others, I learned about Karenizatsiya, indigenization, nativization, and Lenin's nationality policy, where they actually created these nations. And so I gave those lectures in 1991 at Stanford, which became The Revenge of the Past, pushing this new paradigm of the Soviet Union as a constructor of nations. At already a decade after constructivism, thanks to Benedict Anderson, Ernst Gellner, and Eric Hobsbawm, had become a new way of looking at nations and nationalism. And I'm happy to say, I think I'm right in this, I was the first one to bring that into Soviet studies. And that paradigm shift became dominant in Soviet studies. And it happened at the time because nations were, in fact, engaged in politics and were moving toward becoming independent states. So after 1991, there's a flood of people now. There were a few of us before studying Central Asia, the Caucasus, Ukraine, etc., besides those older emigres or captive nation types.
So I'm glad you mentioned Ben Anderson, because you know, when I think of constructivism and the various schools of thought on nationalism, I think Ben Anderson is unique, or not entirely, but let's say of the newer ones, in not necessarily seeing nationalism as as something incompatible with leftism, for example, not seeing it as something necessarily bad. Between 1991 and when your book came out in 1993, a lot happened that I think changed my field more or less completely, and I'm not sure the extent to which it changed yours, and that was Yugoslavia. And you can definitely tell the difference between the generation, in my field, that came of age before Yugoslavia and the one that came of age after Yugoslavia, and even the one that has come of age, you know, with Yugoslavia as its primary founding kind of principle. And the views on nationalism are precisely where you get that kind of those differences. And I'm wondering if Yugoslavia had the same effect on the view of nationalism in the Soviet context as it did. Because, you know, you were talking earlier about how people were thinking about nationalism or nationality before the collapse of the Soviet Union. And certainly the East Europeanists were thinking about it, but they saw it more as a benign force of dissidents. And it wasn't necessarily clear that, you know, like people like Viktor Orban were going to become what they are. Or, you know, that a lot of the dissidents, their politics, basically, because they were anti-political, were completely unclear how they would behave in a real, you know, in a political system where kind of colors would have to be shown and decisions would have to be made. And so nationalism wasn't categorically seen as something bad, but Yugoslavia just, like, changed all of that. And the taint on it became very, very strong. And I think the next generation of East Europeanists, at least, is trying to, you know, like, not even talk about it because the taint is so strong. After a generation of people saying, well, nobody was really a nationalist, and, you know, like, it was all, you know, just, and, you know, these elites trying to force people into stuff. And I'm wondering how the Soviet field has dealt with, or whether it has dealt with Yugoslavia, whether that meant anything for the study of nationalism in the Soviet Union and after.
I don't see how it couldn't have, but I'm not sure the effect has been as great or as dramatic as in your part of the world. I see less criticism of nationalism in the Soviet field, because the main thrust of the criticism is against the Soviet Union, which was seen as an artificial entity. Now, that may be changing. There are students now and others who are working on what you might call Sovietsky Narod, or the identification with the Soviet Union as a positive thing. But in general, the way the story has been framed is nationalism is a more natural, inevitable reaction. People find their right place in their own nation. And things like the Soviet Union or Yugoslavia are artificial constructions that are imposed by left-wing intellectuals or something like that, and which ultimately should fail. So a very powerful paradigm that really needs to be questioned is that empires are traditional and things of the past, and inevitably they will, just by calling something an empire, means that it's doomed ultimately to fail. And I think there are people now who are looking at the Soviet Union in more complex ways to try to see what was working there. And how might it have evolved in different ways? Because the Soviet Union's history is not one, as some more conservative historians think, of simply the imposition of an ideology, what is to be done written on people's backs, or the short course, you know, determining everything. But rather, the Soviet Union's history is a history of constant, repeated improvisation, trying to figure out what this enterprise is about and trying to get it right. You know, is it going to be war communism? Is it going to be NEP? Is it going to be Stalinism? Is it going to be something less totalitarian in the form of kind of Khrushchev's more liberal, if you will, social regime? Is it going to be Gorbachev? And finally, it improvised itself right out of existence. But on the question of nationalism, I would say people come back to it now because of what ultimately happened, but I don't think they evaluate it as negatively as you do now in the post-Yugoslav Eastern Europe.
Well, and, you know, I think people are still, I mischaracterized it, because people are still obsessed with it. I mean, every potential grad student that applies to Cornell is, you know, wants to do nationalism.
I see. Good place to do it. The home of Ben Anderson,
that's true. If only he were still there.
Yeah.
At one point, you wrote something about, I mean, here I'm thinking about class and nationalism as two different, you know, imagined communities, if you will. And, I mean, you've made the case for class being as much of one as nationness, and as real a one as nationness. And part of the way that you argued this is that, you know, people are ready to fight and die for class. It's interesting that, you know, in the case of nationalism, at least the way that the studies have gone recently, people like Rogers Rubiger, for example, it's kind of topsy-turvy, that what constructs communities is having violence perpetrated against you, and that the people perpetrating violence do it in order to make it real, rather than people feeling it to be real and therefore, you know, kind of perpetrating the violence, or, you know, participating in killing. And this strikes me as another place where one could talk about kind of, you know, like genocide and class. So what is it that, I mean, is this a difference between class orientation that If the reality of a class is such that it makes one ready for kind of individual and group sacrifice, whereas the reality of nation is something that can only be produced once violence is perpetrated against a group, or is there something real about these things prior to violence? I mean, how does the willingness to fight and die play into reality versus the possibility that one could be killed play into the reality of a group?
People in time and space have real, or we can call them, they have actual locations, right? Mm-hmm. They speak a certain language, they work in a certain way, they own the means of production, or they sell their labor, or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And then the constructive part is how they begin to imagine that, how they think about it, what meaning and value they give to it, etc. Mm-hmm. And of course, I like the way you put it very much, that is, much of the sense of who you are is often an imposition, mm-hmm. maybe by the people attacking you as well. Mm-hmm. And even as early as the Baku Commune, when I tried to figure out what makes these workers of different nationalities, Azerbaijanis, Armenians, and Russians, come together mm-hmm. at specific locations and times in that city and think of themselves as a social class, what is it that does that? Well, part of it is the dominant discourses, right? So if Bolsheviks or Mensheviks or social revolutionaries can convince people that their interests are one and against capitalists, that helps. If they're attacked by capitalists because they don't raise their wages or they beat them down during a general strike, that helps. In 1918, when suddenly you're now at war and Turks are coming in and supporting one side, that is Muslims, against Armenians and Russians, that changes the equation. Mm-hmm. And so I began to develop an idea which I never fully worked out, that it's the pressure from without that often makes group cohesion and the construction of some sense of identity very powerful. Mm-hmm. And that might be a way to do some research. I think I hint at it in that book. I might discuss it elsewhere. I never really sort of thoroughly in a social scientific way went through that discussion. But mm-hmm. I like the way you posed it.
So how would you characterize the generation of scholars you grew up with? My own advisor, Norman Neymark, in an email the other day referred to you as his blood brother, for example. I mean, maybe you could demystify this term for me. Like, who else in, you know, how, is there anything that typifies your generation of scholars? And maybe Norman is not the best example because he's an East Europeanist, but he knows a lot about Russia.
He does Russian history, too.
Yeah, and started more in that area than in Eastern Europe. But so, your generation, is there such a thing, and what does it look like?
Yes, I think there is. First of all, the people above us, the older generation, I'm thinking of people like Richard Pipes, Martin Malia, Moshe Levine, Leo Heimsen, mm-hmm. they were more contentious, and Mark Ryoth, they fought with each other, they had different strong ideological views, etc. And of course it was the Cold War and the post-Cold War period, and people were intensely involved in politics and involved in views about the Soviet Union and so forth. Our generation, even though we grew up in the Cold War, somehow is less contentious. That is, if you go to Assis now, you find people like each other in general. There aren't so many ideological positions. So you can disagree. Okay, I'm more on the left. Someone else might be more conservative or more critical of the Soviets or some aspect of it. More interested in the gulag. The younger generation seems very gulag-focused or violence-focused or whatever. You know, but still, we're interested in understanding this weird, strange phenomenon, the Soviet Union. And I would say our generation, if you think of people like Sheila Fitzpatrick or my good friend Valerie Kivelson, who does early Russia, we're interested in disaggregating and deconstructing the chronically negative views of Russia. Russia as, you know, abrichina, doomed, as fatalistically committed to slavery or authoritarianism or something of that sort. So there was a much more nuanced and complex view. In fact, one of the things that people joke about was always saying, oh, we have to be more nuanced. We have to be more nuanced. Things are more complicated than that. Well, what statement could you ever make that can't be nuanced or made more complicated?
Right.
You know, my name is Ron. Yeah, well, it's more complicated than that. I also have a second name and a third. That's what we were about, was fighting a kind of oversimplified, negative, Cold War-generated view of Russia and the Soviet Union that goes way back to Olinarius and the first travelers who went from the West to the East and said, these people love slavery and the knout, you know, and they must be punished in order to progress or something of the sort. Mm-hmm. So I would say that, you know, not that we're all in love with Russia. Many of us are. I mean, many of us. It's harder to be in love with Russia today than it was for me to be in love with the Soviet Union. I find this Russia disturbing in many ways. And I was in Petersburg last week, and it's gloomy. I mean, 4 hours of light during the day. And people are in somewhat, the people we know, in despair about what's going to happen. Crisis is about to happen that will only make things worse politically and intellectually. There's a growing nationalism. This whole post-Crimea thing about Great Russia, there's a sense of, again, an exaggerated sense of humiliation at the hands of the West that Putin is exploiting. So, you know, it's easy to turn against Russia. Mm-hmm. Russia will always do something to make you think it is exactly what those anti-Soviets and anti-Russians think. Mm-hmm. But one has to sort of combat that and think about this very more complex country that we're trying to study. And I think that was what our generation tried to bring to it. That's what revisionism was about. Mm-hmm. That's what detentism was about. Mm-hmm. That's what social history and cultural history was about.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was actually going to ask about the divisions within the field and about, you know, because there was also something, was there a Columbia-Chicago thing for a while?
Completely artificial. Made up. Yeah, there is. That is. So I taught at Chicago with Sheila Fitzpatrick, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we had a wonderful group of graduate students, and they did history very much inspired by Sheila. Some did nationalities as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Columbia was more influenced by, let's say, someone like Stephen Kotkin. They went the modernity route. They thought, you know, it's all about modernity, a kind of negative side of modernity, following sort of the Adorno, Horkheimer, Foucault sort of approach to the dark side of the Enlightenment. And I would say we in Chicago maybe were more interested in sort of the way in which Russia and the Soviet Union still maintained kind of traditional and more sort of continuous aspects of the old regime, so neo-traditionalist. Mm-hmm. But those are minor things. Those were, and I don't think there's a big difference. I mean, some of my best friends are people from Columbia, like Peter Hoquist. So I think.
Well, and you yourself are from Columbia.
Yeah, and I went to Columbia in an earlier generation. But I think one of the things that happened was a magazine appeared, a journal appeared, Kritika, right?
Yeah.
And a younger generation wanted to make a name for itself,
mm-hmm.
and wanted to stake out ground.
Mm-hmm.
And they took a very critical approach towards some of the older paradigms,
mm-hmm.
which were, you know, embedded more in the attack on Cold War scholarship. So they were sort of post-revisionists, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, everyone publishes in Kritika now, and mm-hmm. there's all kinds of things represented. And some of the debates are, I think, artificially generated and are a very small change, you know, not that significant.
Mm-hmm. So to what do you attribute the détente, so to speak? Is it, you know, kind of, does it correspond to actual détente, or is it about the stakes being kind of lower now because there is no Soviet Union, or is it the intellectual atmosphere has changed in general?
I think it's that there's no Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. So people don't, we don't have that big enemy. Now, Putin could be good for us. It could bring back more interest in Russia, and it could bring back, you know, some of these debates again about, you know, is this Russia reborn, or is this something particular with this particular personality, or the nature of the the kind of capitalist regime that's been established there. That might be interesting, but I would say that, yeah, you know, Russia's marginal now in the world, in the way that the Middle East and China are not.
Mm-hmm. So when you look at people who, I mean, because I assume you see them a lot because you study now Turkey in part, at least. When you look at people who are in the Middle East field right now, do you feel like you want to sit them down and say, you know, we were in your position 25 years ago. Here's what you need to know about, you know, what it's like to be kind of the scholar that is dealing with the thing that is most important to governments also, but also to geopolitics writ large. Or, I mean, do you see them making similar mistakes or doing similarly interesting things? I mean, how do you relate to watching what has happened with our field, more or less, migrate to another area that you also know quite a bit about?
Yeah, it's interesting that people like you and I, Charles King, who come out of East European and Russian studies, have written now or are writing about Turkey. There's a lot of similarities between Turkey and Russia. Putin and Erdogan look more like each other than they look different from each other. Turkey is a developing society, which is much put upon by the rest of the world and often feels isolated and humiliated by the West, you know, not being allowed into the European Union, etc. What's most exciting about coming into this field is that the big questions, what is Turkey likely to be in the future? Will it ever get into Europe? How will it deal with the question of the Armenian genocide? These are questions that have political ramifications as well. The way in which many of our questions during the Cold War had political resonance in Russia and in policy circles. So we were never distant. You can't write about something even as distant as Ottoman history and not be saying something about present-day Turkey.
Oh, yeah.
So if you talk about Tanzimat, or you talk about Abdul Hamid, the massacres, you talk about the Armenian genocide, you talk about the Kurdish nationalism, you're going to still be talking about things that have relevance today, right? Because Turkey is a country that is itself undergoing this unbelievable transition and transformation from the Kemalist nationalist republic to something much more cosmopolitan and open and potentially democratic, but which at the very present moment seems to be moving away from that toward a more authoritarian system, much like Russia.
So this raises the issue. So about smack in the middle of your career, by my calculation, something happened, which is, you know, a shock to your entire generation, I suppose, and that is that your object of study ceased to exist. And here I'm speaking of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War. Could you talk about how that affected you and the field more generally? Like you personally, you intellectually, and then the field more generally?
Me personally, it was a disaster. I was very hopeful that Gorbachev would achieve a kind of social democratic alternative to what was going on in the West at the time, which was Thatcherite, Reaganite neoliberalism, right? And American interventionism, etc. I thought, you know, Gorbachev had this very utopian vision of a democratic socialist alternative, of one Europe from the Pacific to the Atlantic, etc., etc. And all of that failed. And, you know, the Soviet Union, which I had always been hopeful for, in fact, disintegrated into 15 national republics. And I remember someone saying to me, I actually wrote this somewhere, and it embarrassed people and didn't make me any friends, that someone congratulated me because Armenia is independent. And they said, you have a country now. And I said, I lost my country. And because in some ways, the Soviet Union, though I've never been a Soviet citizen or anything, was at least for me a vision of an alternative, you know, which in its actual existence, actually existing socialism, wasn't any kind of socialism or model, but it always had a potential that we might move towards something better, especially at a time when the United States, my own country, was moving away from that toward greater economic inequality, toward more conservative political hegemonic political discourses toward the failure of a social democratic vision that you saw in the New Deal and in the Fair Deal, etc., the new society. We were moving away from that. So, but you know, that's the world my students live in. They live in this one-dimensional world where there is no alternative. And the alternative is disastrous. So instead of Marxism-Leninism or an enlightenment project of some kind of socialism, now we have Muslim fundamentalism, Hindu fundamentalism, Buddhist fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism, neoliberal fundamentalism. And that's what you're left with. Mm-hmm. The effect on the field was that the archives opened. That suddenly people could study things and learn things in a way that only German historians after the fall of Hitler could have learned about Germany. It's extraordinary. And the flourishing of our field is great. So even as its relevance and its political resonance diminished, the quality of its historiography, blossomed. Mm-hmm. And suddenly we had relations with scholars in Russia itself, and we have exchanges. And I'm teaching at the Higher School of Economics in St. Petersburg, I mean, on the faculty there. And this is a very exciting thing, to be able to discuss and train and help and work with Russian students and other students in that particular setting. So mm-hmm. these are enormous changes, and these are great changes.
Mm-hmm. Well, the prognosis that you painted about right now about the future didn't seem too hopeful.
No.
It was sort of like anti-Fukuyama, mm-hmm. that yes, it's the end of history, but not in a good way.
Right.
And I'm wondering if there is anything that you see on the horizon that is not bad.
Oh, always. You know, we used to say optimist communist, If you're on the left, you have to be optimistic, and you must always fight despair and depression and boredom. And so you do that by thinking things can be changed, and that history is always moving and shifting, and there are alternatives. And that's one of the important roles that critical intellectuals play. We are not organic intellectuals. We are not serving the state or a certain social class or a certain nation. We're serving something like, this will sound naive nowadays, truth, mm-hmm. objectivity, science, and trying to say, look, this is the way things are. They've changed over time. There are alternatives. That's what anthropology and history, I think, more than any other social science bring us.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, however, the move that your generation made, which I like the way you characterize it very much, the one towards nuance, right? Mm-hmm. That it's more complicated than that. In order to get away from the unproductive contentiousness of what came before, right? Mm-hmm. Nuance is not, doesn't lend itself to the construction of a positive program, because if it's always more complicated than that, then it's really, it's always more complicated than being able to,
right.
imagine a utopia, mm-hmm. for example. So how can a focus on nuance produce something powerful and new?
What we should be doing as scholars, as intellectuals, is questioning unquestioned assumptions. Our enemy is what passes as common sense. Mm-hmm. So I tell my students, the last thing I usually tell my students is, look, I know you're confused, but you are now confused at a higher level. Right? In other words, that's what we can bring them, is questioning. That's a good liberal pedagogical thing, right? So I'm questioning some of the things they think are normal and natural, gender relations, as if they're biologically driven, or capitalism, as if it's the answer to human nature. Or, by the way, very importantly, bourgeois democracy, a democracy which thinks corporations are people, money is free speech, that doesn't question the great inequalities that exist. So I still have this kind of, utopian vision. And it seems to me one has to think about utopias, about alternative visions toward which, even if you never reach them, you drive your learning, your politics, etc.
Mm-hmm. So you've been a historian, a political scientist, and a historian.
Yes.
So how do you see or not see the boundary between these two disciplines?
They need each other. Good history often, as I mentioned before, lays out too many causes. Yeah, everything is overdetermined. And good political science tries to simplify things and show what are the principal causes. Political science is more rigorous than most history. It questions concepts very rigorously. You know, how things are coded, they're always looking for that. So I'm not a political scientist who does lots of numbers or formal modeling or game theory, but I'm a kind of softer political scientist who's interested in qualitative methodologies, etc. Mm-hmm. But I find people like Steve Hansen, let's say, or Misha Alexeyev, or people like that, very exciting. I learn from those guys, you know. And my colleague, Anna Guzman-Labusa, Pauline Long-Jones. I mean, these are people who are pushing political science in certain directions that still give us really good answers about the nature of our field and also force us in history to think a little bit more rigorously about what we're doing. So I think the two need each other.
Mm-hmm. What has it meant for you, broadly, being a self-declared leftist studying the Soviet Union?
What does it mean to me personally?
Yeah, or what has it meant, you know?
It says who I am. I mean, I can't think of any other way to put it. You know, that is, I'm a person of the left. I hope for and would work as much as I can intellectually. I'm not much of an activist toward a society that's more socially just, more egalitarian, that questions, you know, the intolerances that are built into racial or nationalist thinking. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it seems to me that has informed everything I do. I think basically what I've been teaching for the 40 or almost 50 years that I've been teaching is alternatives mm-hmm. to the way the world operates at the moment. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's been really exciting.
Mm-hmm. So area studies, how important have they been for what you do, and how has your view of area studies or your experience of area studies changed over time?
I'm still for it, and mm-hmm. I thought that Steve Hansen's presidential address was a great call. Steve argued, let's not call it area studies anymore, let's call it global and regional studies or something of the sort. Mm-hmm. And yet, knowing the whole area, knowing culture, economics, politics, literature, history, sociology, helps inform. And you need that local knowledge, you need that deep local knowledge. So I think that we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, we don't have to call it area studies, but that's basically what we're about. Mm-hmm. And that's been very fruitful. It's helped enormously. The failure not to understand these areas has led my country, the United States, into ridiculous wars and expenditures of manpower and treasure in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. So another area of interest of yours is Turkish and Armenian relations and the Armenian genocide, and you've spent a fair bit of time here in Turkey. You were friends with Hrant Dink, the Turkish-Armenian journalist who was murdered in 2007, and with whom, did he also participate in organizing the WATS, workshop for Armenian?
Yes, he came there several times. Yeah.
Yeah, the workshop for Armenian-Turkish scholarship, which was that groundbreaking series of exchanges between scholars of the region mm-hmm. on the events of 1915, and that was from 2000 to 2012, right?
Yeah,
so
roughly.
Until quite recently. So furthermore, one of your daughters, Anoush, also speaks Turkish, Armenian, Kurdish, and is doing a PhD in anthropology. And your very first book on the Baku Commune has even been translated into Turkish. Can you describe...
It was pirated, but I'm happy it was pirated.
Oh, I see. Can you describe your relationship to Turkey and talk about how it looks to you as a scholar of Russia and particularly of the Soviet Union?
Mm. Yeah, the similarities between Turkey and Russia are striking, you know. That is two very exciting places that are changing, you know, in daily. Mm. That hopefully can move in a more democratic and, you know, European way, but at the moment seem to be moving in another direction. That are both countries, Russia and Turkey, have trouble coming to terms with their history. So for Turkey, it's the Armenian question. It's what to do about the Young Turks. It's how to deal now with Kemalism and the sort of authoritarian modernization that took place in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. In Russia, of course, it's Stalinism, Leninism, the revolution, violence, how to deal with the whole Soviet experience. And it seems to me that in both these areas, in both these countries, historians play a very important role. much more than they do in many countries for that exact reason, because both countries are trying to figure out, is that word that is so controversial, their identities, who they are, what they aren't, and how to come to terms with some kind of political understanding of themselves.
You mentioned in connection with Russia and Turkey how, you know, the two paths stand before them, possibly. You know, one is the authoritarian, and one is, you mentioned, the European way. What is the European way in your understanding?
European way is, and the European Union has done enormously good work in creating standards for joining the European Union. It hasn't always worked out. Look at Hungary. But but the idea is that, you know, recognition of human rights, of civil rights, of democratic practices, of tolerance of minorities, etc. All of these things are good. Now, the European Union is also, you know, a capitalist setup with very often neoliberal policies and so forth. But in general, on the political and human rights side, civil rights side, I think it's been enormously helpful, and it would be good if Russia and Turkey would move closer to those models.
What are its chances?
At the moment, I think Turkey has a better chance than Russia, because Russia is now at war, basically, in Ukraine, and the Europeans are on the other side. I think Putin definitely wants to get out of that situation, but it's stuck there for the moment, and hopefully that will change. But Turkey has a better chance, you know, if it, if Europe were more accepting, which I don't think it is at the moment. But you know, there are very influential elements in this country, in Turkey, in the intelligentsia, in the business community, who want a closer relationship with Russia, with the European Union.
That's interesting, because I was actually asking a different question. What are Europe's chances of continuing to, you know, I mean, of, like, what is the European Union's chance in our world now? I mean, because it seems as though a lot of people in Turkey who used to be enthusiastic about, you know, joining the European Union are not so much anymore.
Or there's an economic crisis, there's the problem with the euro, etc.
Right.
But these will, the European Union will get over those things, I think, you know. And there's always the immigration problem, nationalism, etc. But the European Union is you know, a beacon for a better future, it seems to me.
Okay, so what do you think are the most interesting and exciting aspects of, let's say, historiography or intellectual engagement with the various fields that you work in? Best recent stuff.
Best recent stuff? I would say, let's mention Turkey here first. The new Ottoman historiography is one of the most exciting. That is the idea that you don't do national histories, but you look at a more cosmopolitan, integrated empire in which these complex histories of Armenians, Kurds, Turks, Jews, the Greeks are influencing and affecting each other. And the younger generation is doing that new Ottoman history in a very serious way, knowing Osmanlı, knowing Ottoman language, and learning Armenian or learning Greek. Many people are doing that as well. I think that's very exciting. In the Russian field, I think we've had such a breakthrough since 1991, and moving into the post-Stalin period has been one of the biggest areas. So that there's a real serious historiography on the Khrushchev and Brezhnev periods now, and there will be on the Gorbachev period as well, by historians rather than just political scientists.
Maybe just another question about books. One is, what have been your all-time favorite books, ones that have transformed either you or the field or both, you know, in some big way?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, obviously Benedict Anderson's Imagined Community would be, you know, the first choice. Almost anything by Eric Hobsbawm, E.P. Thompson, George Roudet, all of those people, George Soboul, Albert Soboul, Georges Lefebvre, you know, that whole pleiad of left-wing social historians, Marxist historians that I grew up with, that, that brought us down from politics and history of ideas into the masses of people. There's no book better than 1789, you know, that book. I think it's called The Coming of the French Revolution in English. for study of the revolution. In our own field of Soviet studies, there are great classics. And the classics, you'll be surprised, were three for me. Leo Hamson's Russian Marxism and the Origins of Bolshevism, which was a psychoanalytic study, though that was not important to me. But his wonderful take on those people. Mark Ryoff's Origins of the Russian Intelligentsia, the 18th Century Nobility, in which he talked about the generational shift in nobility. And a splendid book, Martin Malia, Alexander Herzen and the Origins of Russian Socialism, or the Birth of Russian Socialism. Those were the classics that brought me into, I mean, I was coming into the field anyway, but that's what inspired me, those works.
So one last question then. How should we be training the next generation of scholars?
As well as possible. Teach them, first of all, that when they go into the archives, they will see chaos. They will see facts and documents, and they won't make sense. And that what you bring into the archive, before you even get there, are good questions, real serious, well-thought-out problematiques, and historical imagination. That is a way to construct and ask and answer interesting questions. That's the big task. That is, first of all, to formulate those questions, and then to see, with the bits and pieces of evidence which don't quite come together, how you can make coherent arguments and explanations. History is not the collection of facts. It's not the telling of story. It's a serious social science. It has to offer explanations.
Thank you.
Thank you.